Good evening. My name is Perry Hoffman, and I'm president of the National Educational Alliance for Borderline Personality Disorder, and it's my pleasure to welcome you again to our call-in series. We're very lucky tonight to have Dr. Lois Choi Kane, who is the director of the Gunderson Residence at McLean Hospital and instructor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical College. Dr. Choi Kane will be talking on mentalization, which is one of the evidence-based treatments for borderline personality disorder. And just to tell you a little bit about Dr. Choi Kane's background, prior to opening the Gunderson Residence, she completed a postdoctoral fellowship in research on attachment, interpersonal functioning, and borderline personality disorder under the mentorship of John Gunderson and Mary Zanarini. She is trained in specialized research assessments evaluating attachment and is also intensively trained in DBT and MBT. Dr. Choi Kane co-directs intensive training courses for MBT at McLean with John Gunderson, Anthony Bateman, and Peter Fonagy. So please join me in welcoming her to our call-in session. We are delighted to have her. And again, if you don't have the handouts, please email neabpd@aol.com, and we'll send the handouts out to you right away. Just also want to let people know that next week our call-in will be done by Dr. Karen Hall, who's the director of the DBT Center in Houston, and she is the co-author of the book, The Power of Validation, and the topic will be on validation. So let's get started now with Dr. Choi Kane, and again, thank you so much for doing this, Lois.
Thanks, Barry, for having me, and it's an honor to be part of this series. It's been a wonderful series of talks so far. What I'm going to do during the next 45 to 50 minutes is just give an introduction to mentalization, which is, first of all, a social cognitive capacity that we all rely on to manage relationships. And furthermore, to really talk about how this underpins some problems of borderline personality disorder. And lastly, I'll talk about how the treatment of mentalization-based treatment works. We'll see how much we can get through, but as Perry and I discussed previously, if we don't get through all the slides, I'm happy to come back and finish up in the spring. So on the second slide, I just want to thank Anthony and Peter, as well as my colleague Shauna Dowden, whose slides that I borrowed for parts of this presentation. So to just start with, on the third slide, there's a definition for mentalization. And just as a word of warning, sometimes the terminology and definitions within MBT can be quite complicated, but I will do my best to simplify them. Mentalization is defined by the mental process by which an individual implicitly and explicitly interprets the actions of themselves and others as meaningful on the basis of intentional mental states, that is, personal desires, needs, feelings, beliefs, and reasons. So basically, this refers to the both intuitive and intentional work we all do in trying to read other people's minds in social interactions and understand what they're thinking beyond what they're saying or doing. And the same is true for what we need to do of ourselves within social interaction. So on the sixth slide, sorry, the slides are a little bit out of order. There are some definitions of mentalization in a less jargony format. That is that mentalization is really the ability to see ourselves from the outside and others from the inside. It's also the capacity that helps us understand misunderstandings. And in mentalizing, we have to keep our mind and other people's mind in mind with a sense of fallibility. That is that we can guess what's in other people's minds, but we can't know for sure. And in having this ability to be introspective or reflective about what's going on for oneself and others in interactions, it helps us to understand ourselves and our relationships better. So in the fifth slide, there's a depiction of mentalization as inherently relational. So in relationships, there's two people at least, and each person within the relationship has a complicated set of feelings, thoughts, motives, intentions, beliefs, desires, and needs that are involved in the interactions. And each person in the relationship has to do the work of imagining what's going on for each other and managing the interaction at the same time. On the sixth slide, it really outlines what the tasks of mentalizing are, that is to mentalize interactively. So the complicated part about this is we're doing this on the fly within an interpersonal interaction. So as we're talking or interacting, we're really trying to keep in mind both what is going on for ourselves, our self-awareness, and just our best guess of what's going on for the other person. And that really determines how we manage the interaction. And on top of this, we have to manage the emotions that come with all of this. So the challenge for all of us is to be able to mentalize in the midst of intense emotional states. So we can all relate to how challenging it can be to be flexible, realistic, and effective in mentalizing when we're more intensely emotional. So part of doing this is to really be able to combine feeling and thinking at the same time in the context of intense emotions and in important relationships. So the benefits of all of this are that through these shared understandings of ourselves and others, we establish really meaningful relationship connections. And I think that everyone can relate to that, the experience of meeting minds as being relieving, pleasurable, reassuring. And in general, the ability to mentalize flexibly and realistically leads to better interpersonal functioning so that people are happier and more fulfilled in relationships. And we can all also relate to the fact that being misunderstood is highly aversive and leads to painful emotions for all of us. And in particular, many people who struggle with BPD really have both challenges in sustaining their capacity to mentalize and are more likely to experience being misunderstood and therefore oftentimes experience really painful emotions. So moving on, I'm going to explain a little bit more in detail how BPD is conceptualized as a problem of mentalization. And mentalization is very much related to attachment functioning. So I'm going to explain a little bit about attachment theory and the relationship between BPD and attachment insecurity to explain the formulation of how BPD is thought to be a problem of mentalization in MBT. So John Bowlby was the psychologist who really introduced the basis of attachment theory to the field of psychology. And at the time, he had a colleague who was studying young monkeys in the context of maternal separation and social isolation. And what Harlow found was that these young monkeys had a tendency to prefer a cloth monkey mother substitute over a mother substitute that had food in it. And what he found was that there's something really important about the comforting mother figure that provides emotional security and emotional regulation. So in these famous experiments that Harlow did, he showed that when a baby monkey was scared, it would first seek a secure base in the mother, the comforting mother substitute. And that contact with the caregiver helped the monkey to re-regulate and then to move on to kind of facing the problem, the source of fear, so that the attachment itself facilitated an ability to explore. So what Bowlby did with this new idea was really try to promote the idea that human beings are born with a predisposition to become attached and that the attachment has a very important self-regulatory and emotional development function. So in babies, we see that they all are born with some instinctual programming to participate in behaviors that facilitate attachment. So these are familiar things to all of us, like crying, smiling, clinging, cooing. Those are behaviors that babies use to activate or make a bid for attachment. After a bid for attachment is made, the caregiver responds in a particular way. And if all goes well, this results in the child being re-regulated. So in short, what I'll go in more detail about, the basic components of attachment involve a bid, a response, and the effect of regulation or not. Now, it's really important to note that attachment is really a transaction. Oftentimes when attachment is implicated as a problem, that often turns into the assumption that there's something either wrong with the child or with the parent. But I think that it's really most helpful to focus on the fact that there's a fit between a person and their caregiver that really determines the attachment transaction. And when the fit is not functional in a way that helps the child to re-regulate, the instability of attachment results in insecurity, that is, the inability to regulate, contain, and modulate affect. There's also research that shows that this same insecurity interferes with the ability to regulate and modulate attention. This also leads to a lack of a secure base, so disturbances in the ability to explore and therefore build one's life in a way that's self-enhancing. And lastly, these attachment instabilities can lead to disturbances in the ability to maintain meaningful relationships in the future with people. So given the fact that BPD is characterized by interpersonal and emotional instabilities, a lot of people thought it would be useful to investigate whether or not BPD is associated with insecure attachment. And at this point, a number of studies have shown that BPD is associated with these various forms of both disorganized and insecure attachment, particularly preoccupied and fearful styles. And on slide 10, I've indicated some references that are just review papers on this literature. And in particular, BPD is also not only associated with these disorganized, insecure attachment styles, but it's also associated with what's called low reflective functioning. And reflective functioning is a scientific measure of the capacity to mentalize, that is, to understand and imagine the mental states of oneself and others in important attachment interactions. So if we move on to slide 11, what I've tried to do here is to really draw out how attachment works in people who have these preoccupied, disorganized attachment styles. So earlier I talked about how the attachment consists of a bid and a response. This first slide really outlines what the bid consists of for people who have BPD, that typically the bid is characterized by clingy, sometimes angry, sometimes passive or helpless behavior. And oftentimes the attitude towards the caregiver is oscillatory, meaning that sometimes the attitude is that the caregiver is good to them or a good person, and sometimes it's quite the opposite. So as you can see, that this preoccupied style of making attachment bids can be very activating of the attachment. But the problem is that once the attachment is activated, it doesn't manage to re-regulate the person needing care. So the attachment is therefore hyperactivated, but not effective in terms of re-regulating the distress of the child. Now, the other side of the attachment style of BPD is what's called a disorganized attachment. Disorganized attachments are characterized by confused, inconsistent, dissociated conflicted and controlling bids. Just to explain this further, what is found in a disorganized attachment is a conflict between needing the caregiver but also being fearful for a variety of reasons. Sometimes it is because the caregiver is scary, but sometimes it is because the attachment itself is so unstable and inconsistent. Research that's been done on children who have early signs of disorganized attachment in infancy show that as they grow up, they developed these controlling styles of attachment. They can be either hostile or sometimes they're actually quite entertaining and caregiving. And these are adaptations that children develop in order to stabilize unstable attachments. So if you move to the other side of the attachment transaction, to the other person that is the caregiver, oftentimes the responses to a child or a person who makes an attachment bid that's very clingy, angry, and helpless is that the caregiver responds in an understandably overprotective, sometimes over-involved way. And this may happen to just try to soothe and help manage a situation for a child who's very distressed and can't seem to be able to manage the problem on their own. So what happens with this kind of attachment transaction is understandably that the attachment becomes very inconsistent. The demands on the caregiver when they become very involved and have the role of being very protective of this very distressed, hypersensitive child is that they may get exhausted intermittently and therefore become inconsistent, that at times they're over-involved and at times they may be just unavailable or burned out. So this actually just feeds back into the preoccupation with attachment where the child becomes, again, more distressed, mistrustful, and angry and keeps the attachment what we call hyperactivated. On the disorganized side of the attachment, when a child is making bids that are sometimes confusing or dissociated, and behaviorally this may include just freezing or doing stereotype movements like headbanging or clapping or sometimes self-harm, these kinds of bids understandably evoke in caregivers sometimes helpless or fearful responses. And at times when they're trying to take control of the situation, these responses can become hostile and frightening to the child. So you can see how the attachment transaction is highly charged and not effective in regulating the person needing care. So this is what Bateman and Fonagy often refer to as a hyperactivated attachment situation. Now, another way of looking at attachment is through this model that I've referenced to Bartholomew and Horowitz. And what this model really nicely depicts is the fact that internal models or evaluations that we have of oneself and others can also determine and feed into these attachment styles. So, for example, people who have a pretty positive view of themselves and pretty positive view of others can be secure in their attachment. That is, that they're comfortable with getting close to people but also comfortable with independence. Whereas people with BPD have a combination of a preoccupied and fearful style, meaning that in the preoccupied style, there's a very negative view of oneself, perhaps that they can't manage or they can't be safe or they can't do things in a way that's effective. And therefore, that actually drives a lot of dependency on others that they view as quite positive. On the other side of the BPD attachment style is a fearful style, which is driven by a negative view of oneself and a negative view of others. So people who are in this kind of attachment situation are really quite understandably distressed because they feel neither confidence in themselves and they feel high levels of mistrust of others. And oftentimes people with BPD either have conflicts between need and fear of others or they kind of oscillate between dependency and avoidance. So just the combination of these styles in themselves can be highly confusing to people who are trying to provide care or assistance, and that can also drive the ineffectiveness and the hyperactivating effects of attachment for people who have BPD. So moving on to this kind of graphic depiction of the effects of attachment cycles, we can see that an infant or a person provides a bid to a caregiver in an attachment in a situation of distress. And this feeds into attachment style that is fueled by views of oneself and others. And oftentimes the attachment result and the interaction itself reinforces these views. So if the attachment interaction is highly charged and yet not effective in regulating, it may reinforce views of oneself as not being able to manage and more mistrust of others. And then the attachment style in itself can really determine internal capacities, psychological features of how one manages relationships and oneself, and also external behaviors that really reflect problems of mentalization. Now, in this last graphic, the developmental model of mentalization, I'm really going to describe and explain how the attachment interaction facilitates mentalization. So in this slide, I believe it's slide 15 for you all, there's a child on the left side. And on the bottom of the slide, there's a kind of picture of a child. It says constitutional self in a state of arousal. So when infants are born, they don't have the linguistic skills they need to really understand themselves in a more mental or reflective way. So when children are upset or distressed in a variety of ways, they make a nonverbal signal. This is what we call the attachment bid. And the caregiver on the right side has a particular function that helps the child to develop a more mentalized or reflective understanding of what it is they're feeling in their bodies in the moment. So the way that the caregiver does this is by providing what Bateman and Fonagy call marked and contingent mirroring. So this is really important. The contingent part of the mirroring refers to how accurate or responsive the reaction of the caregiver is to the child. So if the child is cold, for instance, and the caregiver reacts by giving a blanket, that's a fairly contingent response. And in a more emotional situation when a child is distressed and feels anxious and a caregiver says something about being anxious or responds in a way that communicates an understanding of their anxiety, this is contingent. Now, it's not just enough to be contingent. It's important to also be marked, meaning that the response by the caregiver is slightly different than just a literal mirroring back to the child of what the caregiver thinks they're feeling or going through. So, of course, when a child is crying and is distressed, the parent doesn't want to respond in an unmarked way, meaning just crying themselves, although at times they may feel like that. But rather, the parent would give some sort of metabolized expression. And oftentimes these faces we make at babies who are crying are these kind of representations of our understanding of their upset. So that in this marked and contingent way, we're representing to the person who needs care what we think they're feeling. And this representation of what the child is going through, if it's done at the time that the child is making the bid, gives the child an early psychological understanding of what they're going through. Now, this develops over time, and what happens for people who have problems of insecure attachments and problems of mentalizing, the reliance on others to give this kind of marked and contingent feedback really continues to be very important. So for a person who has BPD, because there's a lot of uncertainty about themselves and what they're feeling, they may need more of this kind of marked and contingent mirroring from their family members and their therapists and people who are important to them than somebody who has a little bit more clarity about themselves. So just to summarize about the nature of attachment and the problems of mentalization and BPD, people with BPD have these preoccupied, fearful, and disorganized attachment styles that start with these intense, dependent, confused, and controlling bids for attachment. And the attachment that gets activated doesn't actually succeed in re-regulating that person and might, in fact, intensify distress because some of these bids can lead to a lot of interpersonal conflict. Then the caregivers tend to respond in these vacillatory ways or inconsistent ways where they may be over-involved and then exhausted, or these hostile, helpless, or fearful ways. And that also can increase the distress and continue to hyperactivate the attachment. So during these interactions of hyperactivated attachments, mentalizing capacities tend to go offline. And in the next section, I'm going to talk about some signs of mentalizing gone offline. And this is really due to the fact that one's capacity to mentalize either gets overwhelmed or disconnected in the moment when the attachment is highly activated and when emotions are very intense. So what's called prementalistic states, they emerge and lead to symptomatic activity in BPD. That is the interpersonal instability, self-harm, impulsivity, dissociation, and paranoia. And I'll talk a little bit about what these prementalistic states are. So I've just gone over how attachment affects mentalization and then ultimately leads to BPD in kind of the formulation of MBT. But I'm going to talk a little bit more about the mentalizing instabilities because this is complicated. So in MBT, Bateman and Fonagy have really organized the treatment around an understanding that the disorder is defined as a problem of unstable mentalizing. Now, this is an important distinction because people who have just a static difficulty mentalizing might have something more like an autism spectrum disorder. But as we may know from experience, people with BPD actually are sometimes highly intuitive about interpersonal situations and often better at mentalizing than others. But under specific conditions, their capacity to mentalize may become more fragile. And those specific conditions, as I've mentioned, are hyperactivated attachment situations where there's high distress and these activated but ineffective attachments. And also the capacity to mentalize is highly challenged whenever anyone's intensely emotional. And for people who have problems of emotional regulation, whether they're driven by attachment or something else, they are more vulnerable to having problems of unstable mentalizing. So the thought is that when individuals with BPD are symptomatic, this is really about mentalizing going offline. So there are a number of what are called prementalistic states that really are signals for people who have BPD that mentalizing is flagging or becoming more fragile or going offline. And before I go into defining these terms, I'm just going to give a word of warning that sometimes the terms and the definitions are fairly complicated, but please feel free to ask questions about it in the Q&A section. So the first form of mentalizing going offline that is a prementalistic state is called psychic equivalence. And this is where people get into a position of thinking that what's on their mind is what's real, so that when people have an idea, like an opinion, that because my teacher didn't give me my paper with the rest of the class, that means I failed. So when somebody has psychic equivalence, they really hold that idea to be reality, not just a idea or an opinion or a proposition, that there's really a breakdown between what somebody can think and what actually is in the real world. So this leads to a number of different outcomes. For some people, this form of psychic equivalence can take the form of flashbacks, and what's in the mind is really terrifying because one can't separate what's in the mind from what's in reality. Everything feels real. It also can lead to intolerance of alternative perspectives, and this is oftentimes seen in situations where a person who's not mentalizing might say something like, I know what the situation is, and no one can tell me otherwise. And when someone's not mentalizing, the other person in the interaction really runs into kind of this rigidity or brick wall and being able to have an interaction that gets the person to either think differently or feel differently about a situation. And lastly, when people are struggling with psychic equivalence, self-related negative thoughts are all too real. So if someone is feeling self-loathing or self-criticism, there's nothing that balances that in their mind, and they feel that whatever their thought is about themselves is reality. So this leads to an unbearable intensity of self-loathing for people who have BPD in these moments of mentalizing going offline. On the opposite end of the spectrum of pre-mentalistic states is pretend mode. Now, whereas psychic equivalence is about thinking that what's in the mind is reality, in pretend mode there's no bridge between a thought and what might be in the real world. So ideas form no bridge between inner and outer reality, and this can often take the form of feelings of emptiness, meaninglessness, dissociation, lack of reality in internal experience, and this is really associated with self-harm, so that there's no tie to external reality, so people feel more permitted to engage in things where the continued existence of the mind is not contingent on the continued existence of the body. And lastly, one of the ways in which pretend mode becomes evident is in therapy. Oftentimes people with BPD in pretend mode, they may sound like they are really reflecting in a way that's rational and thoughtful, but it really has no bearing on how they feel internally. So that there are thoughts, but they're not quite tied to any felt experience in reality. And lastly, the teleologic stance is the last pre-mentalistic state that really characterizes BPD, and that's a mindset in which the expectations of others are formulated in concrete and only purely observable ways. So the focus is on understanding actions in terms of their physical as opposed to mental outcomes. So, for example, people need to see it to believe it. So acts of self-harm, that is physical acts, communicate internal distress. So the distress is indexed by the action. And oftentimes, the teleologic stance can lead to this situation in which a person really needs acts of or proof of affection or caring by others to really believe it. So, again, those are three ways in which we know that mentalizing goes offline for people with BPD. And this next slide really depicts the kind of complicated factors that go into this for people in general, but in specifically for people with BPD, that, you know, there are these genetic vulnerabilities, early family environments that feed into an attachment system that's disorganized. And in the setting of this hyper-reactive attachment system, people tend to have problems of mentalization. And the important thing to note is that there's a lot of points of input, but a lot of points of intervention as well. So that dealing with a person's poor attentional control or affect regulation can in itself stabilize an attachment system. And trying to work on the hyperactivation of the attachment system can also help facilitate stabilizing mentalization, which we'll talk a little bit more about when we talk about the treatment. So now moving on to the fundamentals of the treatment itself. Mentalization-based treatment is, as Perry mentioned, an empirically validated treatment for BPD. It's a treatment that's shown to improve outcomes related to depression, self-harm, utilization of care, and psychosocial functioning better than treatment as usual. And the long-term follow-up has been positive. So this is a treatment in which they've studied 8 years of follow-up and have shown that the outcomes of improvements in symptoms like depression, anxiety, and self-harm remain superior to those who receive treatment as usual, and their psychosocial functioning also is improved relative to people in treatment as usual. So it's a great treatment, and what's also really useful about it is quite practical. The training is just a 3-day intensive, and the technique is really more process-oriented, and it's more about a stance towards situations than about a set of skills or specific set of content. So the tasks of being a mentalizing person, whether you're a therapist or a family member, is to really monitor mentalizing. That is, when you see a person struggle with prementalistic states, and things become confusing in that kind of disorganized attachment way, that the ways in which a person's communicating with you are conflicted, confused, dissociated, that your confusion about it or not being clear about the situation is really a cue that trying to reinstate mentalizing is the intervention to use. So, of course, while you're doing this, because it's related to attachment and attachment hyperactivates the system so that mentalizing is more challenged, it's really important to also monitor the attachment. And the best way to do this is to use this concept of marked and contingent mirroring. That is to really work on trying to understand what it is a person is experiencing and then represent it in some way that's slightly different than what you feel that they're thinking. So that includes being able to be validating, if you want to use the DBT term, but also giving your own independent or alternative perspective on it. And that really the point of it is to not get someone to think a certain thing or use a certain skill or behave in a certain way, but really the goal is to just promote mentalizing again. So if the idea is that the symptoms of disconnection, self-loathing, interpersonal instability, or self-harm is really triggered by a loss of mentalization, then the intervention of just promoting mentalizing again can stabilize these other symptoms. So back to this slide, it's really important to kind of keep in mind the job of the caregiver in the marked and contingent mirroring. So the stance that's used in trying to do this is to really hold an attitude of really not knowing. Oftentimes people, whether they're parents or therapists, feel pressured to know all the answers or try to interpret things. But mentalizing really promotes an attitude of not being sure but being curious. So that when you're trying to reinstate mentalizing, it's really about asking questions and being curious about what a person is thinking or feeling. And it's important that both the caregiver and the patient, whether it's a family member or a patient, experiences the interactions just impressionistically. So nobody really knows what's going on. So having some flexibility of changing your point of view or entertaining alternative perspectives is really important. So the third point here is to really try to work on identifying differences in perspectives. That you, first, you try to have sympathy for a person's position, be curious about where they're coming from. So saying something like, I can see how you get to that, but when I think about it, it occurs to me that he may have been preoccupied with something rather than ignoring you because he hates you. So being able to understand why a person is thinking the way they are, but then being able to give them an alternative perspective helps someone to start thinking again, that is reflecting about what might be going on in an interpersonal interaction. So as I was just demonstrating, it's really about trying to accept different perspectives and actively questioning what one thinks about a situation rather than landing on something that they think is absolute and usually negative. So when somebody is doing MBT, it's really important to let go of this pressure to feel like you have to land somewhere, that you have to totally understand the situation. The point is more to help a person to just start being more reflective. It's not to do the reflecting for them. And one of the pitfalls of other therapies from the mentalizing point of view is that when you give a patient too many answers, it actually undermines their ability to really think for themselves and really try to describe or be more mental about what it is that they're experiencing, which is usually quite unique. And essential to this process is the ability to monitor one's own mistakes. And as a therapist or a parent, it's really important to be able to say, well, I misunderstood that, or I can see why what I said was non-accurate, because that's a way of modeling that mental states are really not clear-cut and that one can change their mind about things. And this kind of act of owning your own mistakes in the process is not just kind of something to teach somebody who's really struggling with their capacity to mentalize, but it also kind of helps stabilize the attachment situation. So the whole interaction really starts with being empathic, and that you can't really start to introduce alternative perspectives until the empathy is really established. And then you really try to normalize different points of view by owning it and self-disclosing, saying things like, well, if I were in your shoes, I would feel this. So I'm surprised that you appear not to. So being able to comment on what they're saying from your own point of view to not argue or challenge, but rather to just provide an alternative perspective. So in terms of some of the questions that can guide these interactions, therapists will continually question not only the patient's internal state, but also his own. So being able to really truly mentalize in the moment, that is having some self-awareness and some imagination about what's going on for the other person, is important. And that's often guided by simple questions like, what is happening now? Why is the patient saying this now? And oftentimes that may be related to something you've done. Why is the patient behaving like this now? Why am I feeling the way I do now? And what has happened recently in the therapy that may justify the current state? So obviously this really takes into consideration that people with BPD may be hypersensitive interpersonally, and that something that you may not regard as problematic or hurtful or conflicted interpersonally may be having a big impact on the person with BPD. So it's really important to really be curious about how something you may have done may have affected somebody else in a different way from a different perspective. So just to end, I'm just going to go over some pearls about using mentalization. So the first is to really understand the formulation of BPD as a problem of disorganized and insecure attachments, as well as unstable mentalization. And when you're working with someone who has BPD, it's really important to identify the moments where mentalization is lost to help a person to reestablish that capacity and practice keeping mentalizing online when attachments are activated or when their emotions run high. And the essential driving force of mentalizing is curiosity. So the willingness to be curious and mentalize yourself in an interaction with an individual with BPD is really important to sustaining mentalization and stabilizing attachment situations. And the use of marked and contingent mirroring is really important to help someone to manage the attachment, but also to model the fact that people have different points of view. And lastly, in mentalizing interactions, it's important to take stock of what happens, what's effective mentalizing, when it can be restored. So oftentimes it's important to kind of review and say to someone, now that we've talked about this and worked this out, what's the effect on you? Meaning, what's your experience emotionally? How is it affecting our interactions? And oftentimes it really reinforces for individuals with BPD the value of mentalizing. So surprisingly, I did get through all the slides, but there are some resources that I would suggest. Bateman and Fonagy's MBT book for borderline personality disorder, the one that was written in 2006, that is a very readable, short clinical guide. So you can order that. I think all of these books are available on Amazon. The Handbook of Mentalizing and Mental Health Practice, that's more geared towards professionals. It's a really lengthy book, but it's packed with resources for applying MBT in different diagnostic groups and situations. And lastly, Alan's book that he co-edited with Fonagy and Bateman, Mentalizing and Clinical Practice, is also a nice clinical guide that's briefer in length than the handbook, but more substantial than the first book indicated. And lastly, there's a slide to, again, reiterate when the intensive training will be at McLean.
Well, Lois, this was terrific. My gosh, you got everything in, and it's a real credit to how well you know this treatment. I mean, it's just wonderful. And we do have some questions, so let me start with that of them. So here's one question: successful mentalization sounds like wise mind, which is a DBT term. I'm sure that's not a good analogy, but so unsuccessful mentalization look like? For example, when I text David during the day and don't hear back and assume that he's angry, successful.
Yes.
You want to comment on that first?
Absolutely, it is actually quite accurate to relate mentalizing to wise mind. That is, to being able to think and feel at the same time. So when somebody is in this psychic equivalence mode of really feeling something about an interaction and then thinking it's the truth, like if somebody doesn't call you back and you assume that they the worst about their intentions, that is this kind of mentalizing gone offline. And being able to, for an individual who's in that position, even being able to generate some alternative perspectives in the moment can often relieve the emotional pain that comes up, because that's really the problem, is that these states lead to a lot of emotional dysregulation and destabilization.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's terrific. How is the attachment figure of the therapist replaced when therapy ends?
Well, that's really a great question, because I said earlier in the presentation that when individuals have a lot of identity problems, feelings of emptiness, a lot of self-doubt, they may need their attachment figures even more, whether it's family members or therapists, to really be able to sustain their psychological understanding of themselves and relationships. And really, the mentalization-based treatment is oriented to helping a person be able to do that more and more on their own. So while the therapist serves the function and the attachment to help keep that capacity online, the thought is over time as people develop the capacity of mentalizing through intense emotional and interpersonal situations, they will become more self-assured and more clear about themselves and no longer need the attachment as strongly in order to function stably psychologically.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how does MBT involve family members in the support of mentalization for a person with BPD? Is there any emphasis in MBT on repairing ruptures and attachments within the family?
Absolutely. I think that MBT lends itself well to family interventions because it's really a concept that most family members can relate to, that regardless of whether or not there's BPD in the family, we can all relate to having misunderstandings among family members that really are important because of the strength of the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so the interventions are really simply designed around trying to help family members to slow things down and really consider the alternatives of how and why people are reacting the way they are so that they can really, to use a DBT term, like validate more, but simply so that's just sympathizing with each other's positions.
Mm-hmm.
And then being able to talk about it in a way that keeps mentalizing online. Because oftentimes in these really ineffective, conflicted attachment transactions that occur when the attachment is insecure, it's really hard to mentalize when somebody is really emotionally intense and then the bids are really confusing. It really sends a lot of people in families into situations where they themselves have trouble mentalizing, not just the person with BPD.
Mm-hmm. Are there skills or techniques that someone with BPD can practice to improve the ability to mentalize during times of heightened emotions outside of therapy?
Absolutely. So being able to really think about a situation. So when a person with BPD can see in themselves that they're having this kind of these kinds of pre-mentalistic states or assumptions that are pretty familiar and lead to, unfortunately, familiar, painful emotional situations for them, it's really helpful to just back up, rewind to the situation where they first noticed feeling that way. And really think about what they were thinking or assuming about what was going on in the interpersonal interaction. So it may sound a lot like DBT where people go back and do a chain analysis, but in DBT the thought is that the problems arise from the emotional dysregulation, whereas in MBT the thought is that problems arise from the interpersonal interaction and how it's thought of. So if a person could go back in the situation, really think about what they were thinking, and then broaden their points of view,
mm-hmm.
and that doesn't mean to invalidate the original one, but really consider that there are many perspectives in addition to the one that they may have started with, and that just eases people up in terms of thinking that there are a lot of possibilities. There may be more benign interpretations of what's just happened or more effective ways of thinking about it so that interpersonal problem solving can occur.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes these pre-mentalistic assumptions like he just hates me or nobody cares about me, they really don't give other people the entree to respond in a way that also is not mentalizing. You know, oftentimes that state of mind will just elicit a reaction that's behavioral. So that's usually not helpful for reinstating mentalizing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How long does it take when using the technique to quote-unquote overcome BPD? And the writer says, what I understand is that 3 to 5 years of consistent BPD therapy many times allows the patient to be rid of the illness.
Well, I can answer the question more kind of concretely, which is that the way that MBT has been studied was in a period of 18 months of partial hospitalization that included individual therapy and group therapy in a partial hospital setting. It's also been studied in an outpatient setting. But it's really not that it only takes 18 months or it has to take 18 months. That's what we know about the format in which it's been studied. But It is not a capacity that develops overnight, even though we can understand it intellectually. Being able to use it and stabilize the practice of it through difficult times really takes probably at least a year.
Mm-hmm.
Although people will probably see benefits immediately in relationships when they're trying to use it intermittently. And, you know, I think that in general, the course of BPD is known to start to really improve, you know, for most people around 4 to 6 years. So I think the intervention of the therapy itself can expedite that so that the interpersonal functioning and some of the psychiatric symptomatology diminishes faster.
Mm-hmm. Lois, you know, you and I have talked about doing a second part to this, and you did a beautiful job and got through all the slides, but I'm seeing if some of the questions come in, I wonder if we could get you back, and the next time we would focus on family members using mentalization.
Absolutely. I think that would be great because I think that while I got through a lot of the conceptual material about MBT, I think it would be helpful and I think interesting to talk about how families can use the concept and their interactions with their loved ones.
No, I think that would be great. I know that Peter and Anthony actually have come up with a family manual. Do you know of that, and is that something you could help us learn how to apply?
Sure. The family interventions within the kind of group of mentalizing treatments have evolved over time,
mm-hmm.
and they're using something called SMART for families, but I think they've made a treatment kind of protocol that's more specific for BPD.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd be happy to review that with people.
I have to laugh because an email just came in. Oh, yes, please, have her back. So maybe if we could focus it around, that would be great. I do have a more questions. We won't get to all of them, but is mentalization treatment compensated by insurance companies as a valid therapy for borderline personality disorder?
That's a good question. I think that BPD doesn't, unfortunately, doesn't have parity for a lot of insurance companies regardless of what treatment is used. I don't know and haven't heard of any insurance companies reimbursing for MBT specifically,
mm-hmm.
but it's something that we definitely need people to work in terms of advocacy around, and that's something that at McLean we're trying to work with, you know, public health officials around trying to just increase awareness so parity can be achieved first of all. But I don't know that any insurance companies will reimburse specifically for MBT.
Okay. Please compare which aspects of BPD are best resolved with MBT and how does this compare with DBT outcomes?
I think that, you know, the surprising thing is that although it's much more interpersonally focused and reflective than DBT, which is really focused and helpful with the behavioral symptoms, I think the outcomes are fairly comparable, even though the studies aren't really head-to-head, that people really do respond to MBT with reduction of behavioral symptoms like self-harm, and other forms of impulsivity. Also, the use of healthcare, intensive healthcare resources diminishes with this treatment over a period of 18 months. So there's something about the stabilization of interpersonal functioning and emotional regulation that is really effective within MBT. But I think conceptually speaking, what I've found in practice is that when people are really struggling to maintain safety, that is whether it's just physical safety from impulsive behaviors or self-harm or safety within a treatment relationship, I think that DBT can be very graspable and helpful in just stabilizing a person so that they can do something more reflective like MBT. But I think the beauty of MBT is that it's really a treatment that was developed in a public health setting.
Mm-hmm.
So Anthony Bateman works in a public hospital for the National Health Services in London, in a very poor part of London. And this is a treatment that involves a public healthcare system. So it's not something that is expensive or requires a specific set of resources. So in theory, could be a very useful, low-cost, practical intervention for people who might not have the resources to get something like DBT. But again, it just needs to be more available to people in terms of training.
And how can DBT and MBT be used beneficially in tandem? Are they compatible?
I think they are. We do that at the Gunderson Residence, and the people who come to a residential treatment setting like ours really do need a lot of behavioral focus. So DBT is the bulk of the focus in our program. But what MBT does is really complement it with more attention to interpersonal functioning, not just interpersonal skills.
Mm-hmm.
In DBT, there are useful skills, didactics around being more effective in a relationship, but MBT is really more oriented to understanding oneself and others in the relationship more clearly and more realistically. So I think in that sense, they can be really synergistic, because I think being able to mentalize better helps one use DBT interpersonal effectiveness skills more effectively, that is, make priorities and understand situations more clearly. And I think also the skills that are used in DBT to help people tolerate distress and regulate their emotions can actually promote mentalizing. So that's why we do them in tandem in our program. But I think that they're both really effective treatments on their own as well.
And what role does empathy play during mentalization treatment?
That's a great question, and, you know, one of the things that I did during my postdoctoral fellowship was write a review paper on the concept of mentalization, and one side of mentalization is empathy. The other side has more to do with self-awareness. So this person's question is a really good one. Empathy is half of mentalization,
mm-hmm.
and the other half is really, in DBT terms, mindfulness or self-awareness or something that's more oriented to understanding oneself. And the balance between the two is really important, because what I've seen in a lot of people with borderline personality disorder is that sometimes they're either too empathic and not clear enough about themselves, or vice versa. So the balance between empathy and self-awareness are not quite integrated.
Okay. Lois, do you also want to give one more piece of information about the training that's coming up for people who didn't hear about it?
Absolutely. So we do an intensive 3-day training at McLean. We're doing it in January. It's the second week. I believe it might be the 12th through the 14th. It's a very restricted number of people, because there's a lot of one-on-one interaction actually with Anthony Bateman and Peter Fonagy themselves. So there's an enrollment of about 60 people. It's $1,000 for the intensive training. Anyone's welcome. And information can be obtained from Alice Breedice, the CME coordinator, and her email is abreedice@partners.org.
Okay, that's wonderful. Lois, I can't tell you how much, because the emails are coming in just raving about this. So thank you, and I think we've gotten you to commit now that we're going to get you back during the winter series, and we're going to do mentalization with families.
That will be wonderful. And if there's any other questions, if you can just email them to me, then I can try to address some of them next time as well.
Oh, that would be great. And so I want to thank everybody. I want to thank Lois for joining us, and also hope that those of you who found this helpful might think to make a donation to the organization so we can keep these call-ins going. Thank you again, and everybody have a good night. Thanks.
Good night, everyone.
Bye-bye.